Caroline Brothers has a PhD in history from University College London. She's worked as a foreign correspondent in Europe and Latin America and as a journalist at the International New York Times. She's the author of War and Photography and the novel Hinterland. Caroline divides her time between London and Paris. Today, Caroline is on Radio Gorgeous to talk about her book, The Memory Stones, a story about missing people, in fact, missing children. Hi, Caroline. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. I'm so sorry to hear you got a cold.
I've got a bit of a croaky throat, but I hope your listeners can cope with that.
I'm sure they can. So, The Memory Stones is set in Argentina in the 70s. And I'm afraid to say that I didn't know anything about the political situation then. Can you just give a bit of background of why you wrote about that time?
I think that's very interesting. I think people in England and the English-speaking world aren't really aware of quite how terrible it was. There were dictatorships all over the southern, what they call the Southern Cone, you know, south of America. And people have heard a bit about Chile, and they've heard about the mothers or the grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo. But even I was, very much taken by surprise by the things that I was turning up and discovering the more reading I did, and that there was this whole other dimension to the idea of disappearance that, in fact, brings in a whole new generation. So I just found it quite a powerful and quite frightening period of history. And in a sense, you know, where kind of fascism takes us, it's into these kind of situations.
And your book exposes something which we're going to talk about. Has it been written about before in your style ever? You've written it as a kind of fiction book, but it is history.
Yes. I think in Argentina there's been quite a lot of very interesting creative work done by novelists, but there don't seem to be very many other... Occasionally you get a book in translation in English, but I haven't found very many other accounts. There are some non-fiction works, but not very many accounts sort of fictionalizing it, and that was a choice I made because, you know, people often say, oh, why didn't you write non-fiction about this, because it is such a powerful subject. And I could have, I think, but somehow fiction appeals to a different audience and a wider audience and allows us, you don't have to be a specialist. And the book, as you go through the book, I think you learn quite a lot of things about what...
That's what I really like. I love a fiction book that's got historical kind of realism in it. Mm. And then, you pick it up without sort of the stress of thinking, oh, it's a bit heavy, it's a bit deep, can I handle this? Mm. So, but it is. Can you tell us exactly what happens, the key to the story, which is really will shock everybody?
Oh dear, I'm trying to give too much away, but in the the late part of the 1970s and early 80s, a lot of people who were considered dissidents, which was very broadly a very broad term, they called them subversives, but basically anyone who didn't really agree with the regime, was picked up, more or less abducted from the street and put in clandestine jails. And there was a great deal of torture and abuse, and then people were disappeared, which means they were dropped off aeroplanes and vanished, never heard from again. And it turns out that amongst some of the people who were disappeared, you know, taken into detention, were young women that were pregnant. And this, you know, it turns out now that there's something like 500 of these children that were taken, were born in captivity, taken from their mothers, and then given away to friends of the regime, military people, police people. And then the mothers were vanished, disappeared, as they say. And these children have been growing up, though in real life they'd be about 35 to 40 years old now. And the grandmothers of the Plaza de Mayo have been struggling for the past 40 years to try and find them, because many of them realized that their daughters or sons, their partners, were pregnant and have been looking for these children all that time. So it's quite a shocking dimension to think that a child could be stolen from a prisoner and brought up with a completely other identity without knowing anything in a completely different family.
I think the most shocking thing is that they literally, they pinpointed these people. They found women that were pregnant and kind of took them on purpose, didn't they?
Well, it's very murky. I think some of them were, they found out they were pregnant when some were only a little bit pregnant, maybe 3 or 4 months, and some were much later, much more advanced. But there have been court cases that are still I think, coming to an end now, but that established the theft of children as a systematic plan under the dictatorship. Now, I don't know whether it's something that they set out to do initially, or whether it was they found they had these pregnant women on their hands, and then they knew someone, a childless couple, that wanted a child, and so they decided to... There's a lot of kleptomania going along. When people were taken, they'd often take their goods, and I think taking the children was almost seen as part of that. It was a very perverse thing, but they put it into practice in such a way that it became established as a process and as a method, and it was, so I don't know whether I actually targeted these women, or whether it was something that came to them and then they thought, oh, this is a good idea and we'll just keep doing it, you know.
Were there any kind of grown-up, not children, survivors? There must have been some.
You mean of the...
the people that were arrested, yeah.
Yes, there are a few. In fact, one mother survived and had been looking and looking and looking for all these years. And in fact, I think it was about 2 years ago she finally found her son.
How wonderful.
Incredible story. And one of the few to be reunited with the mother, because often the mothers... She was taken to Uruguay, and she was very important because she remembered another woman giving birth in the same jail that she was. And so she was able to provide very crucial testimony to some of the other families. And there were also women that were used as midwives, if they had a little bit of medical training, they might get pulled into these awful circumstances, or else just women that had had children themselves and would help the other pregnant prisoners. So, and a couple of them survived to give their story.
And when was the regime overthrown?
That was, interestingly, not till 83, with the Falklands War, in fact,
God, that's really quite recent.
It's within memory for a lot of us. Mm. And I think the Falklands War, it provoked the collapse of the regime. I think they exposed, it was already sort of hobbling and the economy was falling apart. But it was also like almost the last straw for many people, because their sons were conscripted and there were many killed in that. So it's a very sore point in Argentina to this day. But that is what precipitated the collapse of the regime.
And were there arrests like there were after the Second World War? You know, were people brought to trial?
Mm. It's very difficult in a civil war. I think there's been a lot of to-ing and fro-ing. They've been very brave in some ways, the Argentines. The first prime minister to be elected at the end of the regime, when democracy returned, was like a royal commission, investigating as many cases as they could. And people were still very frightened to come forward and to tell their stories, because they weren't so sure how stable.
They'd lost trust completely,
of course,
hadn't they?
And
they've been living in fear for so long.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then when democracy comes, you're not sure how long it's going to last for. Mm. You know,
and who are these people?
Mm. Yeah, and the military guys are still there. They're all still there. So I think many people bravely came forward, and they think roughly 10,000 disappeared. So the families
10,000.
It's astonishing. But because many people were too frightened to come forward, they think the number is probably, the estimate that's usually used is 30,000.
And could it be anyone, or was it kind of like, I know that Poland, they targeted the intellectuals and the middle class. Was it the same with them?
It wasn't ideological in the same way. Anyone who had any unionist connections, anyone who was an organizer, anyone with obviously Perón was the previous regime, anyone with Peronist connections was also seen as an enemy. But then it started getting wider and wider, and there was a lot of suspicion of lawyers, of psychologists, because there was a theory that psychologists, psychiatrists would hear the secrets of these leftist type people, so they were considered complicit. Then young people were going, there was a lot of effervescence at the time. You have to remember Che Guevara was an Argentine, and Cuba had recently become, and there'd been the so-called 68 revolution in Paris. There's a lot of ferment and fervor, and young people were going out into the slums and teaching Spanish to people that were illiterate, and all those people were seen as dangerous, any unionist as well, because these are people who could organize opposition.
Anyone that cared about people, really.
Yeah, it seems to me, when I try to analyze it, anyone who had some sort of social view, because there was socialism and communism, that was the enemy. And you also need to look at it a bit in the context of the United States, and in fact the war against communism all around the world. So it's part, there's some sort of connections there that are just coming to light now too.
Gosh, absolutely fascinating. Mm. So how did you research your book, and did you go to Argentina?
I did. The book began in in a way, with an interview that I did in Mexico City with an Argentine poet who's extremely famous in the world of Spanish letters and isn't really very well known in the English-speaking world. And his name is Juan Hellman. And he'd been looking for his granddaughter for 23 years and had finally found her. And I just read this small piece in the paper and I just thought, this is an incredible story. I want to know a bit more. Maybe I can write about this. So I went, I was already going to Mexico where I'd been living. And so I went and asked if I could have an interview with him. And he very kindly gave me that interview. That was about 10 years before I wrote the book, you know, and it had been in my mind for such a long time, but it was such a complex story and I wasn't ready and didn't have enough information. I didn't feel ready to write that book, and so I wrote another one in between times. And then, but then when I had a sabbatical coming up, and I thought, you know, I've really got to get this story out of my system. And by that time, more of these young children that had been stolen as babies were coming forward and were being found by the grandmothers, or were themselves presenting themselves with at the grandmother's office. Officers saying,
I suspect.
Yes, with doubts about their identity. And so you were starting to get accounts from, and I was very interested in both sides of the story. So what it's like not only to be someone searching, but what it's like to be searched for, because it could be an enormous psychic shock to be told that you're not who you think you are.
Yes, especially if you're quite happy.
Some of them are quite close to the new family. Of course they are,
because that's a bonding process.
Absolutely.
You know, how many people have been adopted and they say that they feel closer to the adopted parents than they do to when they meet their mother?
Absolutely. And I think that's the perniciousness of all this, the great mess that it makes in the very intimate, you know, emotional ties that we have. And so I went to Argentina, I spent a full month there, interviewing as many people as I could, grandmothers and mothers, and some of the young people, three or four of them my dad interviews with, and then just breathing in the atmosphere, doing a bit of research in the libraries, but also going to places where I didn't quite know yet which ones I would use, but taking the boat across the Rio La Plata to Uruguay and coming back, and just sort of, when you're writing a book, you don't necessarily know how useful all these things are going to be until in the writing process they kind of come up, and that was great.
Can you tell us about Argentina? Because I've never been, and I'm sure some of our listeners haven't been.
It's very, very beautiful country. I mean, it's an amazing place, and I feel like it's a little bit unknown for tourists. It's becoming more on the tourist trail, but such extreme beauty. I mean, you go right down to the south in Patagonia, and there's glaciers that are carving off, and it's, you know, where Darwin went in his voyage of the Beagle. And you go right up to the north, and it's tropical, beautiful beaches and fantastic wine regions. And Argentina, or at least Buenos Aires, the capital, is very beautiful, very, very European.
Is it sophisticated?
Yeah. It's sophisticated, but you can tell that there's been a lack of investment also.
Yes, because it's had so many financial crises.
Absolutely. Yeah. So there hasn't been good investment in transport and infrastructure. But,
hasn't that got that lovely, like Havana, that kind of lovely shabbiness that actually we pertain to because we have this, our lives are so ordered now?
Absolutely. A lot of character and little funky bars and lovely areas of great character. And people are very, very friendly. And
I was going to ask what the characteristic is.
Yeah, they're curious, and they come and talk to you and ask you what you're doing and where you're from, and, you know, and parts of it are just very funky and arty. Like there's one, I mean, they're all on the tourist trail a bit, but with one with buildings coloured where the Italians first came and where the tango was sort of developed, La Boca and San Telmo. But La Boca, all the buildings are coloured with primary coloured paint and paintwork on the walls, and it's very exciting to and great fun to visit, you know, secondhand markets, flea markets, things like that.
Oh, I love that. Now, have you danced a tango?
I haven't, and I'd love to, and I probably should have done it when I was there, because there are classes offered, and I thought, I've got to be serious and continue doing my research. But it's my one regret, so the one reason I'll have to go back, I think.
Caroline Brothers, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. And The Memory Stones is published by Bloomsbury. This is a Radio Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2017. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.